Wolf, get away from those sheep.
Bollocks.
You're listening to the Wolf and the Shepherd podcast, broadcasting from Fort Worth in the great state of Texas. Now, get ready for this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd.
Welcome to this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd. Today we have with us Ryan Pedersen. Ryan, so glad you could join us tonight.
Fellas, thank you for having me.
Hey, Ryan, delighted you could join us. We're actually recording this for the benefit of our listeners a week before Thanksgiving. And we did kind of mull over, maybe we talk about Thanksgiving. I think we did actually talk a little bit about Thanksgiving last year. We kind of read a couple of articles off Google, gave them the 101 version of Thanksgiving. But we decided this year we wanted to go a completely different route and decided we'd go for our ancestors being raped and murdered by giants.
Yes.
Yes, we figured that would be a good different Thanksgiving topic.
Honestly, who better to talk about this than Ryan, right?
Right. Yep.
I mean, Ryan said, you know, I love talking about giants in the past raping people. Yeah. I think that's exactly how he reached out to us. Yeah.
I was searching for a documentary on it, but couldn't find one.
Well, you were searching on the wrong website.
That's true.
Yeah. You got to be careful.
So Ryan, you ran an awesomely interesting Instagram page. What led up to that? Because I was actually searching for this topic and I came across a few people with like a dozen followers and some of the content looked a bit iffy. There was a lot of leaps and bounds without much justification for the conclusions they were coming to. But yours is very, very in-depth. You've written a couple of books on the topic. You do lectures on it. Can you tell us how you got into this topic?
Yeah, absolutely. First off, congratulations to both of you guys. This is definitely switching it up from Thanksgiving, from a typical Thanksgiving message. So you achieved mission accomplished there. And how I got into it is really, I kind of went down the Nephilim rabbit hole that many people go down where, you know, I grew up as a Christian, grew up in the church, studying the Bible, going to Sunday school, and kind of had the traditional understanding of the story of Noah. We know Noah's Ark, that the world was really bad. There was a lot of sin and God flooded the world and wiped out humanity and restarted with Noah and his family. And then, about 11, 12 years ago, I really started getting back into Bible prophecy. And that's when I stumbled upon the topic of the Nephilim or Nephilim. And it really just blew my mind. It just, when I understood that when you seeing not just the account of Noah, but the Old Testament and the whole Bible, and understanding that what the Bible is telling us is that it was not just about people behaving badly and the angry God just judging the world with the flood, that it was really about a genetic warfare, that Satan trying to corrupt humanity to prevent the birth of the Messiah, it completely blew me away. And to your point, the thing I found was that a lot of the books or videos or anything I could get my hands on the topic, I felt they were leaving a lot of ground from the Bible that was not tapped into yet. So I wanted to make a book that really went through scripture that you can bring to any church, bring to any pastor, bring to a school. And it makes a clear case that this was the understanding. This is what the Bible says. And that this was the understanding in the church and certainly in the ancient Jewish community for millennia.
Gotcha. So can you give us kind of the 30,000 foot definition of the Nephilim?
Yeah. So a Nephilim in scripture. So the term itself is an Aramaic term that was borrowed into the Hebrew language, and it really means giants. And who they were, you know, Genesis chapter 6 is where they're introduced in Genesis 6 verse 4. And it says that this passage of the sons of God, which are angels, basically took wives from the daughters of men. So this is saying that fallen angels, sinful angels, took human women as wives and conceived. They had sex and had children. And so the hybrid offspring who are half fallen angel, half human, those are the Nephilim. And they were giants. They were superhuman size, they had superhuman strength, and they overran the world. And that's where the term Nephilim is first used in the Bible.
Now, I actually grew up going to church out of my own free will. My parents didn't make me go. In fact, my parents didn't actually go to church. I went with the neighbor across the street. And I remember reading Genesis for the first time, and I was very confused because it's a lot to take in one book, and it introduces so much stuff, and you're like, okay, I've heard about Jesus, but what's all this stuff? Because, you know, as a kid, they really just give you all the New Testament stuff that, and apart from some stuff like Noah's Ark and Jonah and the whale, you don't really get too much, you know.
Well, but a lot of people also forget the Bible is not one book.
Yeah.
It's a collection of books.
Yeah.
So, yeah, trying to collect all that up in your thoughts, especially being a kid, that's tough.
But what I find now, like when I got into adulthood, I find it interesting how some people will reject things like Nephilim in the Bible, yet they're okay with Noah's Ark and Jonah and the whale. And it's like, well, if you had to pick the three and really look at them scientifically, even if you had no Christian belief whatsoever, the Nephilim in terms of giants walking the earth is probably more likely than the other two scenarios. I mean, you know, from a science point of view, they've proven that, you know, they were dwarves, you know, years ago, you know, like 2.5 foot, 3 foot tall people living. They've found the remains, and they've also found the remains of giants as well.
But
people have a problem believing in giants. They're okay believing in dwarves, but not in giants.
But there's still dwarves today.
Yeah. Well, midgets and dwarves. Yeah. But
yes.
Yeah. But not as a race.
It's so let's not go off on that tangent because you know how excited I get about that. So.
He loves midgets.
Yes, I do.
Oh, okay. Mm. All right. Yeah. good to know. But yeah, no, you're right. And I think a lot of it is just tradition. Once you got to the 20th century, the start of the 20th century in the church, the church moved seminaries. They were moved away in churches from a lot of the supernatural aspects of the Bible. And a lot of it was really just a reaction to evolution, the popularity of Darwinism. And the knee-jerk reaction was, well, we need to get away from things that are going to bring skepticism. And so they stopped teaching these things. And so what I try to bring out in my research and my work is that even when you go back to the early 1900s, but definitely in the 1700s, the 1800s, I quote a lot of theologians, scholars, laymen, laywomen. This is the common understanding. And if you go back to the early church, definitely. So we lost a lot of that. So what I'm trying to do is really bring it back into the discourse in church, that this is a part of the church history. And it, to me, frankly, it makes the Bible a lot more understandable. You know, I told you guys already that, you know, I'm originally from New York City. And you know, it's not the most, you know, you, it's not as Christian friendly as Texas, let's say. And so, you know, you can go out to a cocktail party or an event with friends and you say, hey, yeah, I'm a Christian. I believe the Bible. And the first thing people are going to bring up is, well, why did God send the flood? How is God loving if he just wipes out 99.9% of the human population, women, children? And so, and I don't think there's a good answer for that, honestly, unless you understand what really happened in Genesis 6, that it was a rescue. Because what the Bible's saying is that essentially the human gene pool is coming so contaminated, we are all going to become, to some extent, all part Nephilim and then disqualified from being saved, right? Because this whole thing was about corrupting the Messiah. It was about preventing the birth of the Messiah. And so I think it makes the Bible much more, it makes God much more understandable when you have the proper understanding of the Nephilim and their role in the Bible.
Yeah, and that makes sense. I want to expound on that definitely right after I ask you this question, because we warned you we're going to go off on tangents. So we're talking about the flood story, Noah's Ark, of course, as it's told in the traditional Bible. But, I mean, the flood story has been around for years, Epic of Gilgamesh, all that stuff. The only issue I have with the flood story is, why didn't we get rid of mosquitoes? I mean, who likes mosquitoes? I mean, that would have been the one thing that I would have said, you know, I'm all bought in with the flood story, but couldn't we have got rid of mosquitoes, right? I mean, do you ever think about that?
You know, it hadn't crossed my mind until about 5 seconds ago, but I think that's a good, you know, I think that will definitely earn a chapter in my next book.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So
the final mosquito.
As long as we can write the foreword for that, you can have it.
I'm just glad there's not Nephilim sized mosquitoes, because if you got bit by one, that would be instant bloodlust and you'd be like dead.
No, that's a good point. Yeah. That's an excellent point right there.
This is turning into a movie. We're going from a book to a screenplay.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Why did you not bring your laptop so you could just write the screenplay out while we do this? Right.
It's all up here.
Oh, okay. Good. So let's kind of go back through that biblical part, like you were alluding to in this story about the inability for the Messiah to come if we have this mix of the Nephilim and the human race and all this, and how that applies from the Bible story.
Yeah, for sure. And I think this goes back to kind of what Tristan was saying about how we're taught very little of the Old Testament. To me, and I start really both my books with this, is that the first prophecy you read in the Bible, most of us will know the common story of Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve, the forbidden fruit, the serpent, commonly known story, well-known story. The key part of that story is that God punishes Adam, Eve, but he also punishes the serpent. And what he told Satan is, I'm going to put enmity or war between you and the woman, you and Eve. But he says also, God says between your seed and her seed. And this is the first prophecy of the Messiah. And he says, and God says that the Messiah is going to crush the head of the serpent. He's going to defeat the devil. So from that point, Satan knew that how his defeat was going to come. It was going to be a human child who'd be born one day. And that set his target on humanity. So now, you know, again, God could have destroyed Satan in numerous ways, but he told him it's going to be a child. And so now either preventing the birth of that child or corrupting that child was his mission. And so, and I say in my book how, you know, we don't hear this often, but, you know, when you see, look at even Cain and Abel, the first two sons of Adam and Eve, how Cain, from the Satan's perspective or the fallen angel's perspective, he could have been the first Messiah. He could have been the Messiah. He was the first seed of the woman. And so, of course, we see he gets corrupted. He ends up killing his brother. So I say it was like a two for one. He got the devil got rid of two potential messiahs in one swoop. And so that's what the story really of the Old Testament is. It's kind of a race and a war between two bloodlines. You have the devil trying to stop this lineage that's going to one day lead to the Messiah.
Now, could you backtrack a little bit and make the connection between the fallen angels and the Nephilim? Because I know most people have heard of fallen angels because they all, you know, think of obviously Lucifer. But where the Nephilim suddenly jump into that, you know, without a lot of research, it's hard to make that connection, even if you read Genesis word for word. So could you just educate us on that?
Absolutely. So, you know, it really picks up with Cain murdering Abel. So Cain murders his righteous brother, and God banishes Cain from Eden altogether. And then you have the third son of Adam and Eve, Seth. He's born and he stays in Eden, separated from Cain's lineage, and it allows the line that's going to lead to the Messiah to flourish and grow. And what does God tell everyone? Be fruitful and multiply. So it was human population growth that led to this basically invasion by the fallen angels. So what happened is when you get to the start of Genesis 6, it says, when men began to multiply on the earth and daughters were born unto them, right? So the key thing here is the whole idea of, oh, I'm going to take out one potential Messiah at a time, that went out the window. And so now the devil had to initiate a wide scale attack on the human race to because there were numerous potential messiahs out there. And this led a faction of the fallen angels. So we know that of all the angels that were created, a third aligned with the devil, rebelled against God and aligned with the devil. Out of that third of the angels, a subgroup, a faction of them committed this sin of going into the human realm, taking human women as wives, and committing this fornication to lead to the Nephilim. So the whole idea was, if the human gene pool itself can be corrupted, then the Messiah can't be born. And you see that word corrupt all throughout Genesis 6. It says God saw that all flesh had corrupted itself. that was a testimony. And God said, the end of all flesh has come up before me, to the point that God regretted even creating humanity. So the Nephilim giants were able to reproduce themselves with human women and start just completely contaminating the gene pool. And this was all to prevent the birth of the Messiah.
Now, in the Bible, when it describes angels, you know, the most accurate description, at least to Bible scholars, they kind of look like something out of one of the Resident Evil movies. You know, they've got like multiple, you know, body parts and all that. Were the fallen angels able to take on any form they wanted, or was, you know, the Nephilim in terms of giants, you know, did they choose that form, or could they have come in any type of form? And if so, why did they choose, you know, the form of giants?
Yeah, so I think the angels, right? So the angels who are the fathers, right, of the Nephilim, they, I think, can take on the form of men, because we see this in scripture, you know, where the Bible even says that you can entertain a stranger and not realize it's an angel. So they can clearly shapeshift to take on a human form. But their offspring, the hybrids, the Nephilim, I don't think they had any choice. I think because of their nature being half, basically half divine, being demigods, right? That's really what they are. They were of supernatural size. I think as later generations went on, from the first generation born from angels, they got smaller in succeeding generations. But I think their size was because of this initial, you know, union between a fallen angel and a woman.
Yeah. So, by the way, I am no biblical scholar by any means, right? But I also remember that kind of the next mention of the Nephilim is, I think, Joshua. And this is when Moses has led the Israelites out of Egypt, out of slavery, trying to get to the promised land. Then, you know, nobody from that generation actually goes into the promised land. You got Joshua and one other dude, can't remember his name.
Caleb,
there you go. And but they send the spies into the promised land, and the spies come back and they say, we saw the Nephilim. And that's kind of the second time that it's brought up in the Bible. But there are certain people that say, well, they look at Nephilim because of the old stories as like the boogeyman. And so you say, oh, well, I saw the boogeyman, or I saw the this or whatever. And so there are biblical scholars that say when they went into the promised land, they didn't really see giants. They called it that, but they were just so scared, they said, we saw the boogeyman. So obviously, with all your research done on the Nephilim, I know you've had to look at Joshua. So what's your take on that one?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they were really giants, that they were actual Nephilim. And, you know, when you think about that, like you set it up perfectly, right? So this is Moses and Joshua now. This is right after the Exodus. And in fact, this is about 2 weeks after the Exodus. So when you think about the Exodus, and Moses telling Pharaoh, let my people go, God sends 10 supernatural plagues to effectively destroy the most powerful empire on earth at that time, the ancient Egyptian empire and their armies. So the Israelites witnessed the Nile River turning to blood, people getting covered with sores, darkness over the whole kingdom, but they had light in their kingdom, the death of every firstborn in Egypt, human and even animal. And to the point, and then the parting of the Red Sea, which destroyed Pharaoh and his armies. So they got to witness all these supernatural acts of God, not to mention God also leading them through the wilderness. And then 2 weeks later, they see three Nephilim giants in the promised land, and the spies come back and say, there's no way we can take the land, right? They come back and say, God cannot give this land to us. So that tells me right there that this wasn't just that they saw a boogeyman or a real tall guy, that these were true giants. And also the great detail about that chapter too in Numbers chapter 13 is that when they scouted the land, they brought back fruits. And it says the grapes, they have a bunch of grapes, and two men carrying one bunch of grapes on a pole on their shoulders that they have to carry back. That's how large they were. So even the agriculture of this area where the giants were inhabiting was supernaturally large. So I think that these were real Nephilim giants hybrid offspring, and it wasn't just that they exaggerated or they were scared or a boogeyman or anything like that. And I think that's why the scripture calls them in Hebrew Nephilim is the word, as you said.
Right. Giant or whatever synonym. That's what I'm looking for. Exactly. Almost like a synonym, right?
It is. Yeah. I think the term, the root of the term is giant. The meaning, the original meaning of Nephilim in Aramaic is giant. Right. And so I even talk about how in the oldest version of the Old Testament we have today, the oldest version is the Septuagint, which of course is a Greek translation from Paleo Hebrew, from the old ancient Hebrew. And the word they use is gigantes in that chapter. So they're just calling them again, giants.
Right. So, and by the way, this is truly going to sound like a trap. Okay. But this is not a trap. So you have the mention.
Star Wars reference, by the way.
Admiral Ackbar.
It's a trap. Well done. Well done.
It's not a trap version.
Yeah.
This is optimistic Admiral Ackbar.
That's true. And this might not be a trap, but I just don't want you to feel like this. So we talk about the Nephilim in Genesis 6 prior to the flood. And after the flood, of course, is when Moses has led everybody out of Egypt. And now all of a sudden, here they are again. How did they survive the flood?
You're right. I'm trapped. No, it's a great question. It's an amazing question. So how did they do it? So there are prevailing theories on this. My belief definitely is that the Nephilim DNA traveled through on the ark, and specifically through the wives of Noah's sons, and even then, more specifically, Noah's son Ham. And I think there is some good biblical evidence for why that's the case. And so the first thing is, when you look at the details of Noah's life, there's some very interesting things about him. So one, he had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and he did not have his sons until he was 500 years old. When you go through the genealogies before him of the patriarchs in the Bible, they all had their first sons or first child by 50 years old, 60 years old. Obviously, in the pre-flood antediluvian era, the lifespans were much longer. And so I think that men actually went through puberty probably in their 40s and 50s, and that's when they started having children, reaching marrying age. And so Noah did not have his first son until he's 500. Why does that matter? Because when God told Noah to build the ark, he said, I'm going to give humanity 120 years. He said 120-year probation period before the flood judgment. And Noah got on the ark when he was 600 years old. So by the time Noah had his first son, the world was already being overrun by the fallen angels and the Nephilim. And the Bible's, the testimony of the chapter is, again, all flesh had corrupted itself. So by the time Noah's sons were old enough to take wives and have their own children, the odds of finding a woman who was pure blood human were probably slim to none. And even the way Noah is described in Genesis, it says that he was a just man and perfect in his generations. And that term perfect in Hebrew, tamim, refers to physical perfection. It's the same term you use for a sacrificial lamb. It has to be a lamb without blemish that's sacrificed in the temple. That without blemish is tamim. So I think what the Bible is telling us is that Noah was perfectly human, whereas the wives would not have been. And then I think the second piece of the puzzle to answer that question is that when you look at the giants, like the three giants, the sons of Enoch you mentioned in the book of Numbers, and the other post-diluvian giants, their lineage can all be traced back to Canaan, who was the son of Ham, Noah's son Ham. They can all, that their lineages in scripture can be traced right back to him. So it all goes back to the ark. And I think the wife of Ham.
Now, are there any instances of Nephilim or giants in other religions or belief systems which correlate to roughly the same type of time period, or are they kind of absent?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are many, many accounts of giants. And some of the comparisons that I look to right away are in Greek mythology, right? Which was their ancient religion. Their pantheon is that much of the accounts involve the gods and what they call the demigods, who were half human, half god. So the gods came down, married a human woman, and then had a demigod, the offspring. So I think this is all the Greek riff on Genesis chapter 6. And I even kind of do a side-by-side comparison of Plato's account of Atlantis, which to me is really parallels the Bible, where you have, God Poseidon, who falls in love with the human woman and comes down into the human realm, marries her and has five sons with her and builds this city for her. Very similar to how God built the Garden of Eden, right? It's God plants it supernaturally on the earth. And when you look at Plato's description, there's lots of similarities. One, it had every type of animal species in Atlantis. In the Garden of Eden, Adam's first job is to name all the animals. All the animals come up and he names them. They talk about that in Atlantis, they had precious metals of all types. In Genesis, we're told in the Garden of Eden, there's gold, there's bdellium, there's all these precious metals. And then, of course, as the Atlantis story goes on, they had advanced technology, they had advanced knowledge, and then you had more gods taking human women as wives, which led to corruption in Atlantis, and then it being destroyed with a flood. And obviously in Genesis, you have the same account of angels taking human women as wives, giving birth to Nephilim or demigods, and then the world is flooded. So to me, the parallels, there are too many parallels there for it to be coincidence. And in fact, I even have an illustration of a 19th century rendering of Atlantis based on Plato's description. And I juxtapose that with a photo of a megalith that is in Israel in the Golan Heights right now called Gilgal Rephaim, or the circle of the giants. And it's basically, and they look very similar. It's about 45 tons of stones on a hill in the Golan Heights, arranged in five concentric circles with a little kind of shrine in the middle of it. And it looks very, very, it's almost like a replica of how Plato described the Atlantis, because it was five circles of island interspersed with water. So so I think the parallels are definitely there.
I know it's your turn, but I'm thinking about something. So that many years ago, these demigods or the gods came down, right? Mm. And then created the demigods. So these dudes ruined it for all of us as men, right? I mean, that's kind of how I'm looking at it. I mean, why couldn't it have been the other way around and we had like the female versions come down and let the men of the earth or the males
the mate? The 50-foot woman.
Yeah. I just realized how the ancient history has really ruined us as men, right? Yeah, I mean, that's terrible.
Tough act to follow.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, right? I mean, even, you know, it's, you know, they were worshipped, right? You know, is it right? They were worshipped. So it's, you know, it's no surprise that you see that these beings were worshipped, because, you know, I'm sure the women were mesmerized by them. And, you know, it's kind of that theory where, okay, you know, you bring the women, the guys are going to show up too, right? So
but think about that. Like, you're a god,
yeah,
and you go into a bar. I mean, you're going to be able to pick up any chick in there, right? Mm. Because everybody else is like, oh, are you a god? No. Oh.
Yeah.
So who do you want to go home with? Yeah. I mean, I don't even really need a car. I don't have to call an Uber. I'm a god. I can just make this appear, right? Yeah. How do you compete with that?
Well, you know what they say, big feet, you have to pay twice as much shipping for your shoes from Amazon.
That is true. Yeah.
So when you go back and look at the Old Testament, at that period, why is there such a huge, huge gap before we get, you know, well, I guess not Book of Revelations. When's the first mention of the Antichrist in the Old Testament?
Think that was High School Musical Part 2.
What was that?
That was the Antichrist.
Was it? No.
Yes.
Have you not seen the holiday special? That's the Antichrist.
No.
But there seems to be a huge period where the Bible seems reasonable in its narrative. You've got the shock value up front, then it kind of calms down for a bit, and then right towards the end, you've got more shock value. Why is the Bible written in a way that it's difficult for people to accept at the beginning and then difficult to accept at the end, because that's where it really stretches the belief system when you introduce these stories from the Bible, that the part in the middle, they kind of, well, I can take or leave that somebody came and died for me, but the giants bit and then the book of Revelation bit is really, that kind of really polarizes a lot of kind of 50-50 Christians, you know?
Yeah, great question. I mean, this is a lot of what my second book is about, because my second book, The Final Nephilim, jumps from Genesis to Revelation. And the first chapter, I talk about time and how God exists outside of time. And essentially that everything, rather than think of time in the Bible as linear, it's really a scroll, where events are cycling over and over again. And Jesus even says this in Revelation. He says, I'm beginning and ending, Alpha and Omega, beginning of time and ending of time at the same time, simultaneously. And so I get into that. And I think that the reason why you kind of have these similar shock value bookends is because Revelation is kind of the fulfillment of what was foreshadowed in Genesis. So even going back again to the Garden of Eden, remember, God said, I'm going to put war between you and the woman and between your seed and her seed. And we tend to skip right to her seed, because most people agree the seed of the woman, the Messiah, is Jesus. Whether you're a Christian or not, he is the Messiah of the Bible, of the Christian faith. But we skip over the your seed, where God told the devil, you're going to have a child too one day. And that's who's really going to fight the Messiah, and which is the Antichrist. So the Antichrist is in Genesis right there. And so what I do is, and that's what I like to do, I call a lot of my writing is a kind of a slow drive through scripture, because there's a lot of details that we kind of race past. So I'm saying, hang on a second, let's go back, because God said from the beginning that there's going to be a seed of the devil is going to be born one day, who is the Antichrist and who is the star, you know, the final Nephilim of the book, of the title. So I think that ultimately what we have to remember is that the Bible is really talking about a war that started before we were ever created, and is way beyond our understanding, between the fallen angelic realm and God's righteous angels. But humanity is in the middle of it, because we're the prize in that war. Essentially, it's for rulership over us, dominating heaven, dominating earth. And so you get all the middle books in the Bible where it's more kind of like kings and palace intrigue and wars and things of that nature. They're much more understandable, but ultimately this is about a war between heaven and earth, the forces of good and evil on a supernatural level. And so it's going to start that way, and ultimately it has to end that way. And it kind of, we get glimpses of it through the Bible, but I think if you can't accept Genesis and understand what's at stake here and what's really going on, then the end of the Bible is never going to make sense. And so what I'm trying to do is bring this back into the conversation, that these are two very important books that we have to really look at, because this is what the Bible is really about.
Yeah. And I was thinking about everything that you were saying in there. And I was thinking, I wonder if there's like a reverse Nephilim, because everything you describe, if God was a movie director, he'd probably be Martin Scorsese, because he makes these big, long movies, right? And there's shock value in the front, and there's shock value in the end. And yeah, you sprinkle a little bit like in the middle, right? Just keep the interest, just keep people right from walking out of the theater. But right, but sure. Then like a Scorsese movie, like you get that huge shock at the front, huge shock at the end, kind of thinking, you know, do we actually still maybe have some of the Nephilim coming around, but now instead of being giants, they're short like Scorsese?
Yeah. So that's it, right? So, you know, that was really good. So, and a great comparison, a good analogy too. The answer is yes. And that's really the kind of the crux of the book, is that God said that everything is going to repeat. That if you want, that he's declared the end from the beginning. And like this whole idea that I think that prophecies can exist in multiple phases of time itself. And so, I even talked about how quantum physics kind of is now kind of explaining some of these concepts in the last century. And so I think, yes, we will see a return of all this. There's a prophecy in Daniel that says that in the end times, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men. So again, this idea of mingling the seed, and that even the angels who committed this sin, right? Like I said, it was a subset of the fallen angels who committed this sin of fathering, of marrying, taking human women and fathering the Nephilim. In the judgment of the flood, they weren't killed. The Bible says they were locked in an abyss. They were dragged down to the abyss, which is in hell, and imprisoned there for millennia. Well, in Revelation, they're released. So they return. The fallen angels return to earth. And so there will be a second attempt at trying to, again, mingle our seed, corrupt human DNA. So I think all this will repeat again in the details of the book of Revelation.
Now, Ryan, you've written two books, but I do think you kind of missed a trick a little bit there, because your first book, Judgment of the Nephilim, your last book, The Final Nephilim, in the yes. middle there, you should have had a Return of the Nephilim or the Nephilim Strikes yeah. Back. So you missed out there. I just want to let you know.
Exactly. Well, he was actually smart in that, because once Disney bought Star Wars, yeah. they ruined it, right. except for Rogue One.
Yeah, hopefully they won't take yeah. over this series, because that'd yes. be terrible. Yeah.
So Ryan, please, if Disney calls, just say, can I at least have rights over naming my books?
Yeah.
Stroke me that $4 billion check, but at the same time, just let me make sure that I still retain a little creative control and I'm not making money off selling action figures.
Yeah. Now, where I was going with that, why do you think...
Yes, because let's get the biblical connection here.
Why do you think there hasn't really been much effort to perhaps represent the Nephilim in movies and film as there has been other biblical stories? Because you'd think, you know, giants, all this type of stuff, it would, you know, bring people to come and watch it. I mean, if I was a kid and somebody told me I've got to go and watch the story of Noah for the fourth time, I'd be like, all right, I know what happens, mate. Same thing. Why are the mosquitoes there? But I haven't seen any, you know, I've seen little snippets on the Discovery Channel and the History Channel. But to my knowledge, I mean, there hasn't really been any type of movies or representation in popular movies of the Nephilim. Why do you think that topic's avoided so much compared to other stories in the Bible?
Because once you say Nephilim, you are automatically, in many Christian circles, you're in the fringe world. And I can tell you, there are a lot of Christians who don't believe in this concept at all. They don't think it's accurate. They think it's crazy. It's bizarre. And so, you know, most churches are never going to teach it. And so it's like, you never heard of it. You never learned it. And so it's kind of a fringe taboo topic. My old pastor, when I lived in New York City, was my pastor for a decade. When I first told him, hey, you know, I'm thinking about writing a book, you know, on the Nephilim, he was like, why? That's not, he did not think that there was any credibility to it. And then, but that was also part of my motivation, because I want to demonstrate to Christians that there's a clear biblical case. Just going by the Bible, you can make the case. And he came full circle and started preaching on it. And so, that's the reason. That's why you don't see it in a mainstream movie. I would love to see it. I think it'd be a phenomenal movie. And certainly if I was a kid, I would love to see a movie with giants and, you know, this kind of whole war that took place before the flood, and even the premise, right? Just saying, you know, how many movies open with a prophecy? And just saying there's one day, there's a prophecy of Messiah who will be born one day, and the devil's trying to stop that from happening, right? No different than, you know, the chosen one, right? So yeah, I think it'd be great.
No, I mean, it makes total sense. I seriously think you need to work on that screenplay, because I think we're sitting on something really good. I mean, let's think about the fact that how many movies are just rehashed now. We keep watching all the, you know, let's remake this movie. Let's do a sequel to a movie. I'm waiting for Titanic 2. It didn't really sink, but then it sinks again just so, you know, we can make some money, right? So I totally get that part about looking at that. And so with going into that, let's talk about, as you called, the old book, right? The first book, Judgment of the Nephilim. Don't want you to give away the book, but, you know, pretend you're me in high school writing a book report on a book you didn't read, and so you got to convince the teacher at least to give you a B on the paper because you're doing it the night before.
So Cliff Notes version of the book.
Not only
giving away
too much, because I was too lazy to even read the Cliff Notes. Yeah. You weren't supposed to say anything about that, by the way, but okay. I see how that works.
Yeah, sure. The Cliff Notes version. again, there was a prophecy one day after humanity fell into sin and eternal damnation. God gave them hope through a prophecy of Messiah, a child, a male child who'd be born one day, who'd redeem humanity, crush the devil, and restore righteousness and order in the earth forever. The devil, knowing this, launched a plan to set off a nuclear attack on the human race, sending fallen angels, a faction of his fallen angels, to corrupt humanity by having offspring, the Nephilim, hybrid giants who could dominate, contaminate the human gene pool and prevent the birth of this Messiah. This was such a cataclysmic event that only a flood judgment wiping out 99% of the population could rescue humanity from near extinction. So this is the story, right? And it plays out throughout the Old Testament, is the constant back and forth battle between the devil and his angels trying to prevent this Messiah from coming. This is why when Moses was a baby, you had Pharaoh say, just kill all the Hebrew males under 2 years old, throw them into the Nile River, kill them. This is again why when Jesus was a baby, you had Herod say, kill all the Israelite babies. It was all these plots of genocide where the devil plainly seeks to try and stop the birth of this Messiah. So Judgment of Nephilim tells this story and shows how it weaves all throughout stories in the Old Testament that you never even knew dealt with giants actually were all about this war, culminating in the birth of Jesus Christ.
Gotcha. So before we kind of get into hopefully as fabulous of a description of the first book, I got to ask you this. I'm lazy. I don't like to read, but I like listening to books. Is there an audible version of this book? And if so, please tell me you read the book.
The answer is yes, it is. There is an audible version and I read it. I narrate it and I Fantastic. Even give bonus commentary on it. So yeah. Yes, there is.
I saw that. I read that on Instagram earlier today, actually, that yeah. you mentioned the release of well, it on audiobook.
Yeah, you did more research than I did because yeah. I'm thinking there is nobody better to read this book than him himself. Yeah. I mean, the way you just described that was amazing. So.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Now, and there's a documentary now, too, if you want to watch that.
All right. Oh. Yeah, definitely send us the link to that. Yeah.
Or we'll just find it on the Pirate Network and download it illegally.
But when you first started on this journey, Ryan, what were your belief obstacles where you really had to kind of, I don't know, level yourself to be able to approach this with an open mind? Because when you bring up the topic, and especially if you try and describe the Nephilim in a couple of sentences, most people, it doesn't matter how religious they consider themselves or how faithful, as we said, they do have an issue, and it is on the kind of fringe of Christianity, even though it's introduced right at the beginning of the Bible. What were your kind of belief stumbling blocks, I guess?
Yeah, I think, And there are so many people I can name who led me down the rabbit hole that I learned from, that inspired me to write the book. But I think that one of the big challenges is that it's very easy to veer. There are so many pathways when you start researching the Nephilim, especially if you're just digging online, that can take you into many things, the Bigfoot lineage or down that Sumerian tablets. And so that's really the challenge. And even to lots of occult sources, there's lots of writing about the Nephilim in the occult, going back to, you know, famed occultists of the 19th century. Helena Blavatsky wrote about Nephilim. So that, I think, to me, was the big challenge, is trying to go through all these sources and kind of discern what can I take that's good, solid research to for the book I wanted to write, because I wanted to really make the biblical case. So that was the toughest thing, because there's a lot of information on the Nephilim, but from a lot of different sources. And so it was hard for me to really, it took me a long time really researching the first book. The whole project took about 2.5 years, and a lot of it was just researching. I was going through hundreds of sources to figure out, okay, what am I seeing that's really lining up with the ancient understanding of what's just out there, no substance to it? Because I really didn't want to put something out there where people can say, nah, there's really no historical basis for it. There's no research behind it. I wanted something that could stand on its own.
Yeah. I mean, researching anything anymore, you would think it'd be easier, but it's not. I mean, I'm glad I'm not in charge of your research, because if I'd have read it on the internet, I just believe it's true, right? I mean, once somebody puts a web page up, then that just means that's true. So before we get into the what we're calling the new book, I do have a question for you, and I'm maybe hoping this will lead you into your new book, but probably not. So the most famous giant in the Bible is, of course, Goliath. You have the David and Goliath story. Is there any correlation from Goliath being a Nephilim?
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. Yeah. So he's obviously, you said, the most famous Nephilim in the Bible by far. And he, you know, he connects past and future, right? Because he was a descendant of the Anakim who fled to Gath during the wars in Canaan. In the book of Joshua, they said the last of the Anakim fled to Gath, which is where Goliath is from. The Anakim, you know, were the descendants of the sons of Anak, who the spies saw in Numbers, you know, when Moses sent the 12 spies in Numbers 13, who were descendants of Canaan. So he connects back to Canaan. But also what I write about in the new book is that David, that battle of David versus Goliath, is a complete foreshadow, what I call a quantum repetition through time, of Armageddon, right? You have David, who is God designated as you, the Messiah will come through your lineage. Jesus is called the Son of David in the Gospels. It's a messianic title, battling a Nephilim, right? So battling an offspring, a half hybrid fallen angel offspring. So that, to me, it's a total foreshadow of Christ versus Antichrist. So you have the seed of the woman who will face off against the seed of the serpent. So in fact, to the point that, you know, the second to last chapter in my book is called David versus Goliath, Battle for Heaven and Earth, as a reference to Armageddon, because it's such a foreshadow. And again, that's the big theme of the book, that all these things are repeating over and over again. It's all a cycle in the Bible. So yes, it's a big connection.
Now, are the Nephilim done for now? That's it in terms of prophecy? They're never going to make a reappearance? Or, you know, in the book of Revelation, are there hints towards, you know, when it comes towards Armageddon, that, you know, the fallen angels are going to return, and it really is going to be an all-out, you know, almost like Avengers movie at the end?
Yeah, exactly. Definitely. It's never going to be like that. Yeah. So, you know, so yeah, one, they are going to come back. So again, continuing with this theme, when you see the description of the flood, you have the water came from two sources. It says the fountains of the deep burst. So you have water coming from the ground, and then the windows of heaven open, of course, for heavy rain, right? And so in the end times, in the book of Revelation, you have these imprisoned fallen angels, the Genesis 6, the fathers of the Nephilim who took the wives, they are released from the abyss. And then Satan and the rest of the fallen angels are evicted from heaven permanently and cast to earth. So it's like a repetition of the flood. And I think where you see the Nephilim in that is that, one, the Antichrist will be a literal Nephilim. He will be the literal offspring of the devil. And I think the fallen angels, again, Daniel says that they're going to try to mingle their seed with the seed of men. And I think even when you look at the mark of the beast, right? So the mark of the beast, for those who aren't familiar, of course, is this mark that's described in Revelation, that it's something that's inserted either into the right hand or the forehead that controls commerce. Says nothing can be bought or sold without this mark in the end times, in the great tribulation, during the reign of Antichrist. But I think in addition to being commercial, I think it's also genetic, that when you take the mark, it's actually repeating what happened in the days of Noah, where it's now changing you genetically to something other than human, something other than an image bearer of God. Because humanity, God said, let us make man in our image. So we're very unique in that way in creation. And by doing that, it disqualifies you from being redeemed. And if you look in Revelation chapter 14, it says specifically that if you take the mark, there's no forgiveness. There's no redemption. There's no turning back. So I think it's a repeat of what happened with
now,
the Nephilim.
Yeah. Now, the first time I heard about the Mark of the Beast, I think was the first Omen movie. I wasn't very old, but the very first one, I think, came out in like 78, and it had like Gregory Peck or somebody in it. And it got me, like a lot of people, reading into the book of Revelation. And the passage, I think it's in the King James, when it describes the mark of the beast, is, "Let him who hath understanding reckon the number of the beast, for it is a human number. The number is 666. To me, that kind of intimated that only certain people will recognize this mark, that others will take it, believe in it, something else, not nefarious, but, you know, God has a certain number of people who are going to see this mark, see it for what it is. But it's going to be fruitless almost trying to convince everybody else that, you know, this is the mark of the beast, you know, turn away from this, don't take this. But you know what people are like, especially now, anything for an easy life. I think the majority of people, you know, if you said, let's just stick this microchip right here where ahead of the pineal gland or in the right hand, it's
going to make everything 10% easy. Off, yeah, 10% every time.
Off, 10% off at Bed Bath and Beyond, you know, they're probably going to run with it. So, I mean, in some ways it looks like a bit of a losing battle, because as society, and even in the South here in the United States, as it tends to get more diluted and less religious, and they try and, I guess, make the Bible more digestible. So they kind of soften some of the hard teaching. To you, what do you think is going to be the mark of the beast? Because that's a question I've come across 100 times online. You know, when people talk about end time prophecies, what is the mark of the beast? What's your view on what it is?
Yeah, I think it's going to have, you know, a technological component, right? If we're talking about, I mean, already, and this is when people say, oh, you know, how close are we to Bible prophecy being fulfilled? I just say, well, what is in Revelation? How many things in Revelation can't be done today? And obviously the technology to have something, a device that's inserted into your hand that you can buy and sell with, already exists. So I think it's going to have some type of, whether we're talking an RFID or just some type of chip computer technology that can transmit for sales, that's doable already. So I think it's going to have that component. But again, I think also, on some level, it is going to have a medical component, where it is doing some type of, whether, you know, we think of things like CRISPR or a transfusion, like it, where it's doing some genetic editing of your genome to make you one with the Messiah and with the Antichrist. Because if you think about what you said, you brought up a good point that the goal of the Antichrist is to deceive the whole world. It's not that he's going to come out and say, oh, look at me, you know, I'm going to kill you all, I'm going to bring you all to hell with me, come join me. It's no, he's going to present himself as the Messiah. People are going to believe. The whole idea is he's trying to impersonate the Messiah to be a benevolent, all-knowing, loving being that people are going to want to worship him. And so in that same vein, where you look at the idea of being a born-again Christian, that you're in Christ, that the Christians are called the body of Christ, we're literally a part of Jesus. I think that's what the Antichrist is going to offer. And the key thing about it is that Revelation 13 says that the Antichrist, mimicking Jesus, will suffer a deadly wound, a mortal wound that will be healed. So he's going to, the world's going to see him come back from the dead. And that's when the world says, who's like him? There's no one like him. Who can make war with the beast? That's when they believe this. He's unstoppable. He's God. And I think that's when he extends and says, if you want to be like me, if you want my power, take my mark, and you can be like me. And the interest is an interesting passage that at that time in Revelation, it says that for 5 months, men will seek death and no one can die. And so I think what's going to happen, he's going to offer this immortality. And because of the judgments that come on the earth, at the time that people can finally achieve immortality, they want to die, but no one can die for 5 months on the earth. And I think that's all a part of his offering. So there's a computer kind of technological aspect, but also a gene editing medical aspect to it, that when you put it in, it's going to alter you permanently.
Yeah. So talking more about kind of Revelation, I had read this article. I don't remember who wrote it or when I read it, but that the Nephilim were actually the four horsemen of the apocalypse. I don't know if you looked into any of this, kind of curious about your thoughts about that.
Yeah, that I don't, that's not my interpretation of the four horsemen. So I think that, and now we're getting deep into Revelation. So I love this. So you have the seven seals, the seven trumpets and the seven bowls. That's the series of all the judgments of Revelation. And so the seals are on a scroll, right? It's a seven sealed scroll that, and it says that at the time the scroll, God has the scroll in his hand. It says, no one is worthy to open the scroll. There's no one found in heaven or in earth who's worthy. And then a lamb appears, a lamb slain who's given the scroll. I believe that's Jesus. So I believe when that happened, I believe that that moment took place 2000 years ago. I believe that's when Jesus is returning to heaven from earth. He's given the scroll at that moment because that's when he's worthy. He's overcome death. He's redeemed humanity on the cross, and now he's sitting at the right hand of the Father. So when he opened that scroll, I think that was at that time, 2,000 years ago. And so those four horsemen, I think, are spirits, a spirit of war, a spirit of famine, a spirit of pestilence that dominates, you know, different quarters of the world throughout this age, the church age. And when that comes to an end, that's when we get to the trumpets and the bowl judgments. And I think we see those spirits, those same horsemen are in Zechariah, and we're told those are spirits. There's four spirits who travel through the four corners of the earth. So I think that's more of where that's my interpretation of the four horsemen.
Yeah. And I also believe, by the way, that the Bible is proof God loves ska music, because in the end, there's trumpets and there's bowls. I'm just saying. I think God
followed by a lot of misery, though.
Well, yeah, but maybe that was what Revelation was trying to say. You know, we had that third wave of ska that came in the 90s. And maybe what is it? John of Patmos, he's sitting there and he's listening to some really good ska music. And then all of a sudden, literally, the world goes to hell in a handbasket. So maybe the era of ska was what is already in Revelation, and God's sitting up there saying, man, I really wish there'd be another really good ska album, so let's just end this right now.
Yeah, I kind of prefer to think that, you know, his brain overproduced some DMT, dimethyltryptamine, and he kind of got on the level with God there, not listening to ska music.
I'm pretty sure he's listening to ska music. I mean, you're sitting out there, you're on the island of Patmos, you're writing on this scroll. Wouldn't you like some upbeat, just nice ska music to dance to?
No, not at all. I'd drown myself. I'd throw myself off the island, to be honest with you.
You don't understand. You're talking to someone who's a 100% Jamaican. So
I mean,
and my uncle was for a time a drummer for Toots and the Maytals.
So. Oh wow! Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah, I'm on. Everything I read. See?
follow that up. Now, you British ska hater.
Right, I'm going to change topic there. Now, in the book of Revelation, there's a lot of symbolism, obviously, and people have argued over what that symbolism represents. I mean, with the beast, talks about him coming out of the sea, but people have said that's really representative of coming out of the sea of people in the world of politics. So it's more of a geopolitical rising. This character rises, this charismatic person who like turns society and turns the world around, which have led people say, well, you know, is he going to be coming as a representative of the United Nations and he brings peace to the world, or at least the illusion of peace? But also, you know, with the dragon, there's been a lot of commentary recent with the rise of China being a little bit more ambitious in their invasion plans of Taiwan and Hong Kong, that because, you know, China's traditionally known as the dragon, you know, is that geopolitical, I guess, version of the Bible close to the truth in that respect, or is that a complete misrepresentation or misinterpretation of those things?
Yeah, and before you answer that question, I just want to go on note. I apologize, China, for my co-host's comments right there. We actually really want our podcast still listened to over there. So whoever has been assigned to us, please just mark this off and go ahead and let this podcast go.
Taiwan is an independent country. Taiwan.
I apologize once again for the comments of my co-host. I just want to go on the record. I want to live. Please do not shut my iPhone down, because I really like it. Mm-hmm. Now, with all that said, please answer the question.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. So I think it's half correct, right? So I do think that definitely that the Antichrist will try to or achieve a one world government. So whether it's through the vehicle of the United Nations, it's certainly feasible. But the testimony of scripture is his government is going to be global. And so as far as the dragon symbolism, I don't lean to a geopolitical interpretation. I think all throughout the Bible, when you see supernatural beasts, they are representative of angels. So I think they're either going to be angels or angelic kingdoms is what we're seeing there, and not a particular nation. And really, the ground zero of the Bible is Israel, is the Middle East. And if you think about the Antichrist and his deception, he has to present himself to some extent as being a part of the messianic lineage. He's, you know, if Israel is would never accept a Messiah who is not Israeli, he's not Jewish, or at least pretending to be, presenting himself as that. There's just no way. I can't imagine a scenario where someone could be from a different country, much less a different faith, but different, you know, it's an ethnic religion. So you have to at least present yourself as being in the line of David, right? So I think that's where the deception, if we're looking to a country or ethnicity, he has to present himself that way, because otherwise he's not going to be received, right? And Jesus prophesied to Israel that he said, I come in my Father's name and you receive me not. One will come in his own name, him ye shall receive. And so, you know, that to me, that's prophesying that a certain percentage of Israel, just like the rest of the world, is going to be deceived by the Antichrist. But I can't imagine a scenario where he's not at least saying that he's an Israelite and be even taken seriously by Israel as a, you know, by the Israel, at least by Israel as a nation.
Gotcha. So I want to do a lot of research about the Nephilim. And the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to run out and I'm going to buy your books, right? But like you said before, other than maybe your books and, of course, getting the Bible out and starting to read this, you had kind of alluded to earlier how there's a lot of misinformation and all that. So other than, obviously, your books and the Bible, where would you point somebody to say, I just got to learn more, and I don't really want to learn it on YouTube. So where should I go?
Yeah, sure. So Dr. Michael Heiser, who I cite in my book, he has a number of books. In particular, Unseen Realm is a book that's covers this topic, but also his website as well. If you just Google him, you will find he has a lot of materials that are just in article form or video form that you can find for information on the Nephilim as well. And another ministry on YouTube is Prophecy Watchers, Gary Stearman. He's covered this topic a number of times. And again, these are just interviews, so they're on YouTube. You can just go on YouTube and Google his program, either Gary Stearman or Prophecy Watchers, and just put in Nephilim, and there's lots of, you'll find lots of programming on the Nephilim.
I had a friend who actually texted last week, just before I wrote to you, actually, because I was asking him if he knew anybody who could cover this topic. And he mentioned a guy, and sorry, I'm reading on my phone here because I couldn't remember his name, a guy called Rob Skiber, who apparently is in DFW, and he talks about the Genesis 6 experiment. Have you ever heard of that?
Yes. So so I've actually met Rob Skiber before at a conference in Dallas before I lived here. I came in the conference in 2012. And so he wrote, a couple of books. He wrote articles. I actually looked at a lot of his research when I first started looking into this back at that time. So when I met him, I was on an elevator. I had just arrived at the conference. I was going to my hotel room. So I knew exactly who he was. And it was just kind of like, kind of fanboying. Because I'm like, oh, I was just on your website last week. And so, he wrote that, and he wrote a book called Archon Invasion as well. He's done some excellent Nephilim research. Unfortunately, he actually recently passed away several weeks ago.
Wow.
So he really kind of threw me off when you mentioned his name. Yeah. I was not expecting to hear his name. He actually passed away.
Well, I was not expecting after that wonderful description of all the stuff he did. And by the way, he died. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So while we still want you to read your books, you can't do movie trailers, you know?
Yeah.
Because I could just see him just ruining the movie in the end.
Yeah. Yeah. Imagine him doing the last Star Wars movie. Luke Skywalker, he's dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I can do a much better job than Last Jedi.
Well,
I could be Last Jedi in my sleep.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Last Jedi for me is don't bother.
Yeah. Now, I did actually have a question, Ryan, about the lineage of David. I read a book about 30 years ago, which I know seems surprising because I look so youthful. I read it at 2 years old or something. But it was called The Holy Cross and the Holy Grail. And it was one of those books based upon the belief that Jesus, you know, had a lineage. And as I read further across the years, it was saying that the Antichrist would perhaps claim to be of the lineage of Christ, which is why he would be accepted and revered even among some of the believers, that, you know, they would believe this tale that, yeah, he's directly from the lineage of Christ. Have you read about any of that stuff about, you know, Christ having a wife and kids and...
Yeah, definitely. I've read a lot of that stuff, especially, I mean, this in two iterations, right? So first, you know, back in, again, around that time, like, you know, 1999, 2000, I was in law school. That's when the Da Vinci Code really blew up. And I started doing not just reading the Da Vinci Code, also just the materials. And I think Dan Brown might have even cited that book in Da Vinci Code, that that Holy Blood, Holy Grail book. And so I started looking into all those things. And then again, it kind of came full circle once I was writing my first book, looking into that again. And I think that's actually, you know, kind of an interesting theory that the Antichrist could say, I'm a part of this, the actual messianic bloodline from Jesus himself, right? And so I think that could definitely be part of the deception. As for the credibility of those texts, the Gnostic Gospels, I don't give them credibility. You know, they were, even at that time that they were written, which is kind of the second, third century AD, where you had, you know, they were rejected by the theologians in the church at that time, and their interpretations of Jesus having offspring and having his own lineage and marrying Mary Magdalene. There isn't historical support to that from ancient accounts at all. And the other interesting thing too is that people don't realize is that at that time, after the writing of the Book of Revelation, you know, the Bible really, from a literary standpoint, radicalized the world. You know, that's why even the idea of making a book in a book form, that's how the apostles were giving out the Bible, sharing it as opposed to scrolls. That really, Christians are really the first to use a book format, which is why the Bible is called the book. And so after Revelation became popular, there are lots of books written like Revelation. Like there's the Apocalypse of Elijah, the Apocalypse of Peter, the Apocalypse of Paul. So there was lots of this literature was being written that was kind of riffing on Revelation. And then you had other, so it became its own genre, essentially, this apocalyptic literature. And then you had other accounts like the Gnostic Gospels. So there were lots of books like this kind of running around that were getting into other things. There's a book called Jonas and Jambres, that's just about the two sorcerers who Pharaoh had in his kingdom who could perform miracles in front of Moses. So I don't think they have credibility or they're inspired books. I just say that so people know that this was happening a lot. There were lots of these accounts. I think the Gnostic Gospels was just their own version of, we're going to write about what we think happened after Jesus rose from the, you know, rose and after the resurrection. What did he do later on? Or what did he do when he was a teenager? So there were all these things I think they were trying to fill in gaps that, while interesting, I don't give much historical credibility to.
Yeah, I read an article, and admittedly the website I read it on had a mixture of stuff which seemed a bit out there.
Babylon B.
No. But it was mentioning that, you know, it was something like Ancestry.com now, which is absolutely huge across the world. And recently, you know, over the last few years, it introduced this, you know, if you send a blood sample, it'll work out your DNA and tell you, you know, like Elizabeth Warren, you know, you're 1/5 millionth Indian or whatever.
Or you could actually just do genealogy work and trace it back for free on the internet.
Yeah.
However, Ancestry.com, if you would like to sponsor our podcast and pay our salaries for the rest of our life, we would be more than happy to allow you on the podcast.
But I recently filled out a profile on Ancestry.com, and I was trying to find my lineage because I was adopted when I was age 2.5. So I didn't really have much, you know, kind of record of going back past my dad. You know, I didn't know my mother. But, you know, other people, other relatives, even like second or third cousins had also across the last few years been on ancestry.com. And so when I started typing things in, it gave me hints to, well, this person is probably related to you. Do you know these people? And it kind of connects it all together. Now, it wouldn't be very difficult, I guess, if somebody had nefarious intent of trying to prove that Jesus had a lineage and it leads to this Antichrist. Because all it takes is, well, look, you know, if we go back this many years, we go back to this area, there's definitely a chance this guy's a direct descendant, you know, of the line of David, you know, like one of Christ's kids. It wouldn't be that hard to convince people with so-called science that this would be a very real possibility.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, right. And it's all about deception, right? Jesus said, the disciples asked him in Matthew 24, what will be the sign of your coming again and the end of the world? He said, deception, let no man deceive you. So I think that could definitely happen. If you think about what the devil's doing, so much of it, again, is imitation. And what I point out in my first book is that when you get to all these chapters in the Bible with the lineages, Abraham begot Isaac, Isaac begot Jacob, it's like, wow, it just goes on and on. God is providing a record that can show from Adam to the Messiah, to Jesus, the mission was accomplished. The line was not broken. It was not contaminated. So the lineages in scripture are very, very important. And so it would not surprise me to envision a scenario where the devil wants to mimic a lineage. And so, look, here's my Messiah who he can trace his lineage right back to Christ. So that I could definitely see that being a part of the end times deception. It's a very, very, very good point.
Yeah. So, Brian, as we close here, I mean, we could literally take up the next like 7 hours of your time. I mean, you're a fascinating guy, full of a lot of information. I mean, we just kind of jumped into this on the Nephilim, but here we are in this. And I'm serious, like we could go several hours. We don't want to take up any more of your time today. So can you let everybody know how they can find the books, how they can find you on social media, website, all that good stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And just before we get to that, I just want to make one point is that I think that the overarching points and themes of both my books, and we've hit on lots of the important topics, though, is that it's highlighting that the Bible story of the Bible is a story of redemption. It's about a family that was broken. God is trying to reunite all his children back with him. And that is all the battles, the wars, the intrigue. That's really the overarching theme. So I just wanted to make sure I drove that home, because that's what I try to communicate in my books. That this is a story of God's love for humanity and how God is repeatedly rescuing us from our own mistakes, from our own peril, and pulling us back. And it has to end. And it's a war. You know, a good father will fight for his children, and God is fighting for us and will continue to fight for us until Armageddon. So just wanted to make sure I highlight that theme.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm glad you did, because hopefully maybe in the future, you know, these books are going to get huge and some kid's going to listen to this podcast and have to write like a one paragraph synopsis and they are literally just going to copy that. Yeah. Cause that was wonderfully done.
Uh-huh. Thanks. And to that kid, you're welcome. You're welcome, my man. You're welcome. Or my sister.
Yeah. Well, hopefully like your great, great grandchild will get some kind of royalty check for like, you know, what to us would be $100, but by then that might buy them like half a lifesaver or something like that. If we're still allowed to have candy in the future.
That's it. Yeah, no. Awesome. Awesome. And, but to answer your question, to find me. So my website is Judgment of the Nephilim, one word, judgmentofthenephilim.com. That's the easiest way to contact me. My books are there. I've had two study guides for each book. There are also documentaries that I filmed with the Hollywood film crew. If you want to just get all this information at night, get out your popcorn, you can enjoy that. My social media, my Facebook, my Instagram, and my YouTube channel are all also just Judgment of the Nephilim, one word. And those are the easiest ways to find me.
Well, cool. Ryan, it was a pleasure. It was great meeting you. Seriously, we want to have you back. We're seriously going to sit here and brainstorm and be like, okay, Ryan's going to have to walk us through this and this and this and this. I mean, it was a really good conversation. And that will do it for this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for all the support. And we will catch you on the next one.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd podcast. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, thewolfandtheshepherd.com, to your friends and colleagues. And please leave us a positive review on iTunes when you get a chance. Check us out on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for additional content. Join us next time for another episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd.